The Gatekeeper. Inside Risk and Consequence. Der neue Podcast über Führungskultur und Wirtschaftskriminalität.
In conversations, we normally give more information than we should.
I'm already scared to open up now.
Each one of us has vulnerabilities. The most sophisticated person, the smartest person. Putin let that Labrador into the room, knowing beforehand that Merkel is afraid of dogs.
I actually think that this kind of manipulation is actually wired in us through evolution.
All those things that you have put online and you consider as strengths when you come to an interview, I will now use them as a vulnerability, to use them against you.
How does your wife know you don't manipulate her all the time?
Welcome to today's episode of the Gatekeeper podcast. In this episode, we will examine how open source intelligence and psychological insights can shape the outcome of meetings and relationships. We will explore how social engineering has evolved into a critical risk within high-stakes legal and business environments, where trust itself becomes the primary target. Our discussion will focus on how individuals, lawyers, executives, and advisors can be subtly influenced through well-crafted interactions, data-driven profiling, and relationship-building tactics, sometimes leading to enormous damages for companies and individuals. In addition, we will explore the ethical art of persuasion, a particularly relevant skill for lawyers and legal professionals. We would like to approach both topics through concrete, real-life examples. In order to do so, today we are joined by Adi Schiffer, who brings extensive experience in analyzing how influence works in high-stakes environments and how professionals can better understand, anticipate, and respond to it. Leveraging extensive experience in civil services and cybersecurity firms, Adi provides expert and personal guidance to families and organizations on navigating the complexities of information gathering, encompassing both technological and human dimensions. His approach is informed by a distinctive blend of perspectives and practical expertise, deploying proven methodologies to address the evolving challenges in today's dynamic environment. Today, he is a partner at Forentech, a Swiss firm specializing in cybersecurity, digital forensics, and investigative services, supporting law firms, financial institutions, and public authorities in handling complex cyber incidents and investigations. My name is Max Beckert. I'm the co-editor of the Gatekeeper Journal and a lawyer at Baron Carr. And today, together with Joel Fischer, publisher of the Gatekeeper and head of the investigations and compliance practice at Baron Carr, I have the pleasure of conducting this interview with Adi. Adi, we are thrilled to have you with us today.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Adi, what exactly is social engineering?
Social engineering can be described in two main elements. There is the negative part of social engineering, but also the positive part of social engineering. Most people, I think, today know social engineering from their cyber awareness courses. So one thing that you can describe social engineering at is the art of manipulating people into revealing information, giving access, or taking actions they normally would not do. So for example, I would social engineer you or manipulate or trick you into clicking on a link that eventually is a malicious link. So obviously that's a very clear bad area of social engineering. The other part is, and could be explained differently, is the art of understanding and influencing human behavior to build trust, foster collaboration, and guide conversations toward productive outcomes. So basically, we can say it's also a positive thing. So if you put two people in a room and eventually they have a common cause to reach to a good goal, if one has more leverage or understanding of the situation than the other, they can actually guide the conversation towards a meaningful and productive outcome based on understanding the situation, understanding the other person's motives and his take on life, and obviously understanding about the information or the positioning that that person is coming from in that particular area. So I would say that social engineering is the intentional shaping of perception and behavior through controlled interaction. That's the bottom line, and that's how I would classify it.
So you said we have like the good and the bad. So, you know, as a lawyer, I always start with the bad. So can you give us a real case example of social engineering, you know, where it was like a bad one, like when it used badly?
So like I mentioned, the lowest common denominator of social engineering attacks would be, like I said, in more in the cyber area, where we would have those phishing campaigns or somebody manipulating an employee of a firm to actually doing something that they're not supposed to be doing, like giving information about a firm. And then it's basic manipulation. But what I'd like to talk about in the bad area, and I think this is affecting today firms, is the trust area. So many firms today have social engineering attacks conducted on them by people being inputted into a firm, eventually to have access to high positions, information in critical areas, eventually creating trust among high-level senior people, and eventually giving data back to sources that they're not supposed to be given.
So that's basically undercover. It could but in a bad way, right?
It could be undercover, and it could be not. It could be just certain people that have decided to hurt the company and decided to do it maliciously. And therefore, they would gain the trust of the CEO or the CFO or somebody in high position, and they would engineer situations where that person would give them more and more information about the firm that they do not have access to, and eventually bringing that information to themselves and to threat actors or bad people or competition or people that are not supposed to have this information. In those social engineering areas, basically, there's many examples of this in today's environment. The most common cases would include one company trying to better understand what the other company is trying to do, and therefore creating scenarios where, for example, I would impose myself as a HR representative of a specific firm. And I would approach a senior partner in a firm that I'm looking to find more information about. And I invite you for an interview. And basically now what I'm doing is I'm social engineering a situation where I am bringing you into an area where you feel comfortable to talk about the firm you're not supposed to talk about, your company, about what you're doing every day. And now, after I've put you into that situation where I'm giving you the incentive and I'm reading about all the information about you online. So this is the part where open source information investigative area comes in, where I would research you and your information and your strengths and your vulnerabilities and your family and your hobbies and your likes and your dislikes and your education and your position. And that basically, all those things that you have put online and you consider as strengths when you come to an interview, I will now use them as a vulnerability to use them against you. So, for example, if I knew, let's say, what are your hobbies, Max?
Like to play football, tennis, sailing.
Okay, sailing. Let's talk about sailing. What do you do in the sailing area?
I just sail on lakes, not on the sea so much. I'm a very bad sailor, but I enjoy it.
Okay. This is something you read about?
No, I don't read about it that much. I just practice it in my spare time.
Okay. But you enjoy speaking about it?
For sure. I'll tell you all about it.
Okay. If we engage in a conversation, Max and I've realized that Max liked some sailing, let's say, newspapers or videos online, and this is very simple to know this, I can imagine, and I start speaking to Max about his sailing hobbies, Max is now put in a situation where his emotions start to open up and he starts to feel comfortable with me and he's starting to let his guard down. Mm. And now I'm in a position to social engineer the event into allowing Max to speak more and more about himself. And therefore, later he will start to feel at the end of the conversation that he really enjoyed it.
I'm already scared to open up now during the podcast.
So it's about gaining trust?
At the end of the day, it's about gaining trust. It's about gaining trust. Social engineering is up and foremost. Even in your classical cyber attack, your classical social engineering, think about it. When you receive a phishing email, what is the purpose of the email? Why don't you click on that link? Why don't you click on it?
Because I don't trust the source.
Exactly. Not only the source, but also the content.
Right.
What if the content was very distinctive towards your hobbies or something that you like or love?
Right.
Would that increase the chance of you clicking on the link?
Yeah, of course. Right.
Okay. Like if I sent Max an email from something that looks familiar to him and talks about sailing and an event that will happen next week on Zurich Lake, I think Max will be very intrigued to find out what is in this email, right? So that increases the chance of Max actually clicking on that link. Mm. So you'd say that's the lowest level of social engineering, but it's very easy.
Right.
The higher level is gaining trust for long-term situations where I would actually maybe somebody in your firm that you feel you trust and now is working to gain more and more trust, to get more and more information, to use it as a threat actor in a bad way.
Usually, is it the case that, let's say the other way around, you want to place someone within the firm to gather information? I'm talking undercover, that what you mentioned, Joel, before. These scenarios, is it usually individuals in your experience that are placed within the firm purposefully for that very purpose? Or is it employees, already existing employees that are targeted?
Normally, it's the second one, because that's the easier one. To place somebody internally would be much more complicated. Normally, it's easier. And again, I'll speak about motives in this podcast. Motive is a very important thing in this case. If you understand people's motive, you understand that seldom it is money. Normally, it's about pride, about ego, about emotions, about being passed on in a certain situation. And then when you take advantage of that vulnerability, then that's where you are able to play with the area of making people do something that they're not supposed to do and engineer a behavior.
So let's go through this like step by step. So first you said vulnerability, right? So what's exactly a vulnerability and how can it be identified, right? You know, how you start probably the analysis of the vulnerabilities.
So the first method to use that is using open source intelligence investigations about a person.
Hi.
We all have a digital footprint. Our digital footprint is basically everything that we have put on the internet, everything that we have done, and some things that we have not put, like our family has put, our friends, our colleagues that have taken pictures of us, our kids, our parents, and even business transactions that we were part of. Maybe we have not put anything willingly there, but the second you were part of a firm or you're a partnership, that becomes a digital footprint, whether you like it or not. You know from your investigations, you know that very well.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes your vulnerability. So the first element is actually online investigations, but more deep investigations. If you really want to build an understanding of who's sitting in front of you, that's the raw data.
Right.
The second part is taking that raw data and building something that will help me adapt to you on a personal level from that raw data. Something that I will use as a mechanism to get closer to you, to gain your trust.
And so what could that be, for example? I assume there is some method behind that, right? So let's say you know all sorts of information about the person, right? So what are points where you can start? You know, what are like starting points to get a vulnerability?
The starting points, and as I mentioned, the starting points would be, first of all, try to identify personality of a person.
Right. Okay.
Okay. The more information I have about a person, of things he wrote, he or she wrote, videos, obviously would be the best. These kind of things would actually help me determine the personality of a person. Let me share a public example. Okay, of something that was very interesting. In 2007 in Sochi, Mr. Putin and Mrs. Merkel had a press conference. And during that press conference, there's a photo op. Putin allowed a large black Labrador into the room. You're familiar with this?
I know the story, yes.
Okay, I think maybe even we shared it one time. So Putin let that Labrador into the room, knowing beforehand that Merkel is afraid of dogs because she had in the past an incident where she was bitten by a dog. And Putin knew that. And imagine a room filled with photographers clicking and then a dog coming into Merkel's lap,
yeah,
and kind of around her. You can see from the video how her positioning changed, how her body language changed, how she understood now that Putin is sending her a message.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So he is socially engineering a situation.
Right.
To embarrass her, not only embarrass her, but also putting doubt in her mind, what does he want to do later? What does he want to achieve from the meetings? And this is a very unpredictable element and for Angela, and she was very, very uncomfortable in that situation. Okay. So for example, that is something that if you know something about a person, you can actually create a situation in a room where you are purposely giving the other side a situation of uncomfortableness, but later to engage that in the next steps.
Right.
It sounds like there's two layers to that. Like firstly, there's the fact that you want to make that person feel uncomfortable to use it afterwards in the situation later on. But also it sounded like she knew or might have known that this was done on purpose. And that's also a second factor that comes in, that you have the feeling of fear, a sensation of fear, and asking yourself, why does this person do that? What's coming up next?
That's exactly the point. So in this case, it's a social engineering event where she understands it's a social engineering event, mm-hmm. which is even right. more sophisticated.
Right.
Because then she's thinking, okay, what's going to happen in the meeting now? Where is he taking this? Why is he doing this? I mean, she understands at some level, but she has to analyze this by herself.
Right.
Okay, as opposed to a controlled environment where maybe she has a few advisors giving her some thoughts or ideas how to better protect herself. But now she has to kind of manage the situation and control it. And fear is involved, which is very difficult to hide. Fear, shame, these kind of emotions are very tough to battle, especially when you're confronted with them live.
Right. So you said it's the personality. Are there different types of personality that have different vulnerabilities? And can you, if so, I don't know, can you describe these personality types?
Okay, so I'm not a psychologist. I think that we all have vulnerabilities. Each one of us has vulnerabilities. The most sophisticated person, the smartest person, at the end of the day, vulnerabilities are back into our emotional state. And those are the areas that we have to see how we take advantage of. Now, I cannot map here all the vulnerabilities of different type of personalities, but later in the podcast, I do give an element how going into a meeting with a person that has more narcissistic traits, how you can maybe try to social engineer an event where you convince him to ask you to do something.
Right.
Because it has to be his idea.
Got it.
As you know, narcissistic people mostly want the ideas to come from them. Otherwise, it's not considered a good idea.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. And so later, when we talk about how to social engineer a situation into right. Something that benefits you, how we can make that happen, maybe by creating the right environment. So, yeah, our vulnerabilities, I think, is something that over time I've learned that each one of us, if we look at our, first of all, digital footprint and how we behave, and we more realize what our vulnerabilities are, then we can take them into the emotional side.
Got it.
So if you don't know me, and we're the first time we meet, mm-hmm. and now we start talking about your sailing activities, etc. Now, maybe at the end of the meeting, you might ask, let me think for a second. Is this person genuine, or does he really want something out of me? Out of this conversation.
So vulnerabilities are, let's try to get in a bit into that, because also, you know, it would be interesting, you know, how we can find our own vulnerabilities, right? I think that would be the, so vulnerabilities are probably things we are fearing. Our fears are probably vulnerabilities. Things we fancy, so things that we think are great are vulnerabilities. Our desires are probably our vulnerabilities. What else? What else are vulnerabilities? Fear.
Things we are ashamed of.
Fear ashamed of, okay.
As young kids, the first thing, if we did something wrong, what is immediately our first emotion? It's shame.
Shame.
And then fear of getting caught, right. you know, by our parents or some authority that is important to us.
Right.
So those are the immediate elements.
Right.
So if you want to actually take control of a conversation and make somebody feel, you see in some conversation, especially in business conversation, you see that somebody comes with more authority. Some people are afraid of authority. They don't feel comfortable with authority. Mm. I may tell you, Joel, please go get me a drink. If I am very authoritative and you fear me a little bit, you'll go get me that drink. Some people will not respond to this and say, Adi, go get your own drink. Okay? So everybody has their areas where they're feeling more vulnerable. And first of all, understanding, let's say, what you post and how you react to certain situations. Are you apologetic a lot? Are you sorry for your existence? You always have to say, I'm sorry, I apologize, I'm sorry, I apologize. That's okay, something that you feel more insecure.
Hmm.
You can notice that. Everything that comes out of our mouth means something. Every sentence we say or we write means something. And you can see that also in the emails. I'm sure as lawyers, you see that when a potential client comes in, you can see the first things that come out of their mouth. I can imagine that as attorneys, when you interview a client or a prospective client, you first let them speak without stopping them, right?
Right.
You let them dump all the information that they have currently in their head.
Right.
Why? Because the first thing that come out is normally more truthful. And those are the things that are more, let's say, troubling for them.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That is correct.
It's accurate,
I can imagine. That's true, for sure. And
so you can imagine that those few things that come out of your mouth are the most important things that they will want to be addressed.
But how can I myself understand what my... How can I, if I say I want to protect myself, how do I find out what are my vulnerabilities?
So, first of all, therapy is good.
Okay.
If you're not a big believer in therapy, I would definitely, like I said, I would go back to two things. Number one, raw data. Examine yourself. Check yourself what is available on you.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is ask questions. Be curious at the end of the meeting. If that's a meeting that you're not sure about, listen to your gut. Your gut tells you a lot. This is also true in the ethical part as well. Okay? We're dealing with human beings. A lot of the times you come out of situations, you say something didn't feel right. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. That's another element. So information, feeling, and questioning.
So what does questioning exactly mean?
Questioning is, did this situation, where did it come from? Who connected me to this person? Is this person hiding a different motive that they're trying to get from me? Do they have an agenda besides the agenda that they put together? Were there questions that were asked that were not normal questions in this situation? And did I give answers that may or may not jeopardize something about this relationship or other relationships? So that's something that when you think about at the end of the meeting, what you have said or done, this is something that you have to think about. Was this a meeting that was detrimental to you and to the environment that you're in? You can prepare better for the meeting. And this I talk about a lot, about setting clear goals and understanding what you're going to achieve in each single meeting, especially if that meeting is very important. And once you set those goals, you have a clear compass of where that meeting is supposed to go. And if it sidetracks, then you are very conscious of that sidetrack. And then you understand that something just went wrong and something doesn't look right. And that's when your gut starts to think as well.
Got it.
Do you have a strategy or advice for a situation where I realize I might find myself in such a moment where I might be the victim of a social engineering attack, I'll call it attack for the moment, and how to respond in that very moment? Because these are very thought through processes that we talked about now, you know, thinking about our vulnerabilities, analyzing maybe beforehand, but also in hindsight, our opponents or conversation partners' behavior, questions, and so forth. But in an Angela Merkel situation, what can she do? What can we do?
In this kind of case, if you look at the video, she cannot do much. She can try to create a straight posture and go with it. And then inside a room with Mr. Putin, she can maybe turn the tables. She can maybe go on the offensive, or at least she can now decide how to manage that situation, either to let him feel like he won, but actually getting maybe another goal achieved on the side. So use it to her advantage. So say, okay, I lost this battle, but I can win the war by getting what I want. Say, okay, you tried to humiliate me. Maybe you even succeeded. Now I'm going to get something from you when we go behind closed doors that you didn't think I was going to get. So you can do that by asking more questions.
Yep.
Always asking questions. Go, I want to say on the offensive, but it's not really offensive. But again, I would not reveal to the other side that you feel that there is a certain problem here. I would now try to understand more the situation and to get to the bottom of it by asking more questions. And or... maybe giving input that you now decide to give input inside that meeting that could be maybe a bit deceiving or maybe different input to see what happens with it.
In a company, who is, let's say, the most vulnerable or who is the biggest potential victims? Is this dependent on personality? Is it depending on position? You know, are the people that are you going for that, you know, the attackers go for at actually rather low level or rather, or the other hand, rather high level? Who would it be?
Just like any attack, if the front door is open, you're going to go through where the front door is open. Okay, so it's easy, it's accessible, and to get what you want. Obviously, you want to get the higher, the better. The more information there is about a person, the easier it is to get to him or her, then the easier it is eventually to form an act of social engineering. If the person has a very minimal digital footprint, then you can see that they're very introvert and they're very low-key. There must be a good reason for that. Always ask yourself why. Hmm. Why do some people keep posting a lot of things on social media and some people do not?
Hmm.
And close their accounts and keep them very, very private and have just one sentence under their, you know, their position. And some people have full paragraphs. You can find them linking full paragraphs of people, and that's okay. But they really describe what they've done and what they have succeeded and what they arranged and what they, everything they have done throughout their career in details. And then you can see that somebody really wants to share something with the world.
Mm. Mm.
So imagine meeting such a person that has just detailed their life on LinkedIn. Like, you can imagine that if you ask them one question, they will be very open about it, very open in other things as well. So I would call it low-hanging fruit, but eventually there's not one most vulnerable person. When we create assessments about companies to see their digital footprint, I can very clearly tell you by the amount of data that is available online about people that posted, liked, interacted, etc., who is more extrovert and who is more introvert.
And generally, the more data that is available on you, the more vulnerable you are.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Are there any industries that are particularly vulnerable at the moment, maybe even, or generally?
Wow. Obviously, financial industry is always anything that has to do with R&D. Obviously,
yeah.
Anything that's, you know, towards AI, all industries today suffer from this. There's not one particular industry. We see this across the board. The more successful the company is, the more competition there is, the more people want to know. Adversaries, competitors, whatever you want to call them.
All of this is more hidden. Like, how significant would you say are all these social engineering operations? I mean, you know, you have like the scammer thing, but let's take that for a second away. Let's say corporate espionage or other thing. How significant would you say are these? Like, I mean, we see it in our practice, but normal people don't see that every day. So how do you think, is that really something that you don't see that much, but it's really a lot there? Or how big is this threat or how big is this, you know, field?
It's a huge field. I can tell you that normally I get to cases only after the CEO or the high-level position has realized that there's a problem inside the company and he's being betrayed. It's very difficult for people to accept the fact that they're being betrayed by somebody that they trust for many years. This is a very, very big field. It happens all the time, mostly from people that are disgruntled employees or people that are not happy for whatever reason. And it happens on the higher level. And most likely, most of the time, I can tell you that 9% of the cases that I have dealt with, it has been people that are close, very, very close and confident to the senior people. It will not be lower level people because the damage that they can create to a company is not as big. Think about it. How much information are your lower level employees are exposed to? Maybe besides the secretary to the CEO. Okay, but that's right. An exception to the rule. Most people do not have access to most information. But the senior you are, the more information, access to information you have, and the more access you have to positions, and you have the ability to influence decisions as well. From all the cases that I've dealt, most of the cases, it's always been from the higher level positions. And it's a very big business. Unfortunately, or fortunately, companies decide to resolve this in-house. And you know this better than I do, because this is a very bad reputation situation. So companies right. decide to resolve this internally and not take it externally, as opposed to a cyber event where you have to report it and normally it somehow comes out because most of the employees know about it because of the end.
Is it even discovered, or in how many How often is it discovered? If, say, companies address it internally, they need to be made aware of it in some way. How can companies become aware of those situations?
Many times it's not discovered. I don't know what is not discovered, but many companies eventually do discover it. And they discover it sometimes because somebody brought it to their attention, or the CEO felt like something was wrong, or they found a transaction that was not supposed to be there. And then they started investigating and saw that this has been going on for many years. That's how normally, or a whistleblower, that's normally the areas that it would be. It's very difficult to find that out. There's different ways and different trainings that you can do to try to bring these people to surface or to make them make a mistake. But then you would have to at least understand that something is wrong in your firm, or accept that idea. And most senior executives don't really accept that idea that something could be wrong in their firms, because of the notion that we all live by, that this will not happen to me.
Right.
And today's a good day, and tomorrow's going to be even a better day. Because we don't wake up in the morning thinking something bad will happen us today. At least most people don't.
Right.
Let's say the normal people don't.
The less neurotic ones.
Yes.
Are there estimations of, let's say, how many percentage of such cases are actually discovered? Let's say if 10 cases are discovered, does this tell us that there are probably 90 more? Or, you know, it's always difficult to estimate, but are we seeing like a big part or a small part of all these cases?
So, again, this is based on my intuition and also what I see in the field. We do not know a lot of those cases. Most cases are not being revealed, just because people don't even accept that notion of looking into those cases.
Right.
But if there's proper cultures and proper procedures in different organizations, the chances of this going on is lower. So it's tough to say in percentage. It's tough to say numbers, and I don't want to just mislead with numbers.
Right.
But like I said, most of the times we get to these companies when there's already a problem.
Got it. And when there is a problem, what should you do? Let's say you had such a case and then, you know, there is a problem. What are the steps?
You're talking company specifically, right?
Specific, yeah.
Yeah. So the first step is you start investigative work. First of all, you have to talk to attorneys, to your lawyer. You have to understand the problem, and you have to, first of all, put that in some capsule where you have put together a team that you trust, only external team, because you don't know internally who could be relevant to this case. You don't know at this point. And then you have to understand, normal from outside counsel, what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do, depending on the jurisdiction that you live in and what rules you apply. And the first step is to assess the situation. And that's investigative, forensic. And then you start to form a plan that you start to collect information, collect data, to startly lower basically come towards the person or the people that you think are right now causing harm to your company. After that, you form a plan that eventually, if you already understand through the forensic investigation who this person is, that will help you for the next steps. But that's the easy part. If you do not understand and you just have suspicion, then you're in a different area. And then there's different types of situations where you can actually apply some investigative analysis on people, information OSINT, learn more about them, see their activities, see the irregularities, see their social networks, see who they're connected to, maybe adversaries. There's a lot of investigations that can happen in the background that you can do, of course, legally, without allowing the other person to really know what's going on. So basically, it's a lot about collecting information and forming a plan of the next steps.
How would you think do new technologies, you know, I'm thinking AI, deepfakes, impact and change the landscape of these threats?
Tremendously. Today, I can tell you that, especially in the blockchain area, North Korea, for instance, has armies of deepfakes. Video, audio, today all I need would be a 5-second sample of your voice to create a real identical voice. Video the same, you can download any app today and it's you can create a deep fake video of yourself. I can create a deep fake video of yourself in no time. Very, very easy. There has been already cyber attacks where actually a CFO there was somebody imposing to a CFO when he brought together a video call of staff. You know this?
Yeah, I know this. Yeah, tell it.
Yeah, so I think it was Hong Kong, if I'm not mistaken. That actually a CFO brought together a company meeting and eventually instructed, and somebody was impersonating the CFO, his voice, his video, everything. The whole group. And eventually he instructed people to make a transfer, a very large transfer of money. And that was all done through deep fake. And imagine now, how can we know who to trust? How can we know who to trust? We're actually going back in time.
Exactly.
In the trust area, where you have to have like a physical meeting with somebody to understand whether to trust him or not, whether it's him or her or not. So we're actually going back to old methodologies.
That was a crazy case. I think there was a transfer of 25 million because of this call.
It's exactly in the case. But these are staged. I can tell you that North Korea, like I said, has a lot of AI, advanced technologicals to try to get blockchain accounts, because obviously that's a lot of money and they're targeting a lot of companies. There have been a lot of cases that I know of interviews where an AI was being interviewed by a company for different positions in blockchain companies in order to get access and be hired without actually seeing the person. Because today, imagine, in today's world, a lot of companies hire remotely without even seeing the person ever. Mm. That's very common today.
And the gut feeling might be very difficult to
Very difficult. Very difficult. Extremely difficult. And today it's perfect. I mean, we all use AI just for correcting our emails. You know, in the past you would say, okay, this doesn't feel real, but today it feels more real than us.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So many, let's say this is state threat actors, they are doing this. This is also trickling down to the corporate espionage part. And this is something that is probably will be used more and more. For 2026, the projection is that at least 50% more AI-type social engineering campaigns will take place, and it will just go on and on. Imagine where we were in January 25, AI-wise, and imagine where we will be in December 26, AI-wise. Think about it. Think about that transition. So, yeah, it's becoming more and more. We'll get to a part where AI can manipulate you and social engineer you into doing things.
Right.
So even sending that email talking about Max and sailing and generating that email like it's just by reading your open source information and then translating it to an action. Agentic AI will take an action and it will tell you, hey, Max, why don't you, click on that link? Because there's something good behind that link.
Mm-hmm.
And you can scale it up, right? Because before, it was more work, but now you can scale it up.
Yep. And the question always remains, how to protect ourselves from this? And unfortunately, I don't have a good answer. I really don't.
That was my question.
Unfortunately, I don't have a good answer, because I think the technology has moved so far ahead. So I'm better on the human interactions.
Right.
I have to say, on the technological interactions, we will have systems in place. We will have mechanisms where we don't trust anything that happens in the digital area, especially when these actions are detrimental to our company. We will have to use other mechanisms to find a way to lower the risk there.
And let's say it's difficult to say how you can protect yourself, but maybe let's try it from the other way around. What are the most common mistakes, at least the mistakes you can avoid that can lead to problems that you have? So what are, if in your case or generally, what are the mistakes that you see people do, and what can we do? How can you avoid doing them?
That's a very general question. I'm going to put aside for a second the technological, elements on your phone. Let's assume that your phone is up to date, and let's assume that all the technical parts are taken care of, okay? Because this is not a technical conversation.
Right.
I think that many of us are vulnerable in a way that in conversations, we normally give more information than we should. People react in a very unique way to silence. Most people have the tendency to complete silence with information that is not supposed to be revealed, because we do this out of uncomfortableness and thus creating another platform of entrance into our world, into information that is not relevant. So I think once we understand our personal information, once we understand that we don't have to give all the information on the first shot, once we understand we can limit the amount of data that will be exposed, and I'm not talking about basic interactions, I'm talking about more high-level stakes where things are important, in a meeting, in a negotiation, in an event where we have to be the mediator, let other people speak. Let other people engage. You will still have the upper hand. The more information you have about the other side, the better it is for you to plan the next steps. Think about it. Let other people talk first and create a silent situation where other people have to engage and have to give out information that they're not supposed to use. And be aware if somebody's using it against you.
It's very interesting. We've spoken a lot about the passive side kind of now, right? How to interpret behavior, how to protect ourselves against those actions. Now, let's maybe move a bit towards the active side, how to make use of, let's say, a positive form of social engineering or maybe persuasion. But before we do so, I'd be interested to know your opinion, whether we are all in a way somewhat social engineers, often even without realizing it. Are we doing this subconsciously in our everyday conversations or business conversations, or what's your take on that?
So my take is very clear. We manipulate each other every day since we are young. Our kids manipulate us every day. We manipulate our coworkers. We look at manipulation as a bad word, and many times it could be. But it's also something that how we interact in our daily lives. How many those who have children know when a child looks at you with those eyes and asks, "Daddy, can you please read me that bedtime story? Just one last story." That's a manipulation. Your child is emotionally manipulating you. You have done this to your parents. That's how they grew up. You most likely agreed. Then they saw that it works, and that's how you grew up. And now when you need to get something from a coworker, you may manipulate them.
Right.
Whilst you understand if they're more emotional or logical, you will appeal automatically to each of their sides.
Right.
So we manipulate each other almost in every conversation to do something that we want to be done.
I actually think that this kind of manipulation is actually wired in us through evolution in biology. Like, there was an interesting book that, you know, I read about, you know, general evolution, and they were talking about drongos. Do you hear about drongos? Drongos are like birds, and these birds are the ultimate social engineers. So the birds, they steal the food of others. For example, meerkats. And how do they do it? Like, meerkats, they get these animals, but meerkats are very, you know, they are very vulnerable, right? Because, for example, if an eagle comes up, you know, it can just get them. So they always have a lookout. So what does the drongo do? The drongo, you know, goes next to the meerkats, and if an eagle comes, he warns them. He makes a sign and warns them. And so he does it like two, three times, and that's the way meerkats get trust in the drongo. Right? And once the meerkat trusts the drongo, he does it without an eagle. He just does it, and then the meerkats just go away, and then just takes all their food. So it's like he basically tricks them. He's a real social engineer. But it's getting better. He's like a really good one. So then the next time he does it again, and this time the meerkats, they don't fall for him anymore, right? Because, you know, fool me once, okay, but, you know, the next time they don't, and they tell him, go away, right? So he does it again. And that's also interesting, because when he does it again, he gives the meerkats the feeling they got him, right? And then what he does, the next time, he can mimic the sound of the outlook of the meerkats. He can make exactly the same sound as the meerkat. And then he does this sign, and then, you know, that's our outlook, and they go again, away and he takes it again. And he can take this like several times, and that's complete social engineering. And you know, that's drongos, but you know, you see, for example, chimpanzees, they have exactly the same. So, you know, like the lower chimpanzees in a food chain, you know, they are generally dominated by the alpha. And sometimes they say, oh, there is some sort of, you know, a danger, and everyone runs away, especially the alpha, and then they get all the food for themselves. So I think it's kind of a evolutionary, you know, advantageous behavior. And I think, you know, we are actually all deeply wired in with that.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. And the idea is, and you asked this, once you realize that, then you can use it to your advantage.
Right.
And when once you realize that your son or daughter is actually manipulating you into something, you realize that. Now you can use it to educate them about something else, or you can use it to your advantage. And then when you grow up, you can use it in business scenarios, in friendship scenarios. Again, it doesn't have to be a bad thing. It doesn't have to be. What is the source of manipulation? Basically, somebody's asking you of something. They're requesting you to do something because they need it. It's their need, and they're asking of you to do something. Now, some people have a straight way, you'll go get me water. And some people have to say, you know, I'm very thirsty. You know, I'm really thirsty, Yoel. Please, I'm really thirsty. Okay, can I get you water, Adi?
Yeah.
Okay. So it all depends.
I used to silent thing.
Oh, yes, you do.
I can imagine.
Yeah, which leads us to an interesting point, right? Which is what persuasion techniques are actually effective in practice, in your experience? What techniques should be applied and which are less effective?
So again, that answer to that question is it depends. It depends on personalities. And here it's very important to understand the personalities. Now, it's not in the level of let's be a psychologist and really learn those personalities or the behavior patterns. If you know somebody, then you know more or less the reaction and you know what makes them tick. You understand what is more painful for them and what is easier to absorb. I can tell you that we have marital disputes, you know, when people are separated, especially when it's high profile or especially when it's people that have a lot to lose or to gain from a certain separation. Many of them, you see them at the end of the day going to court and battling each other to death. They don't care. Death is the easy way out for the other person as far as they are concerned. And I'm sure as attorneys and lawyers, you know this, you've seen it, probably make a buck or two out of it. That's great. But all jokes aside, at the end of the day, if you understand the other side, what they want to achieve, and I'm not saying something that people don't understand, but you understand their personality. And framing here has everything to do with it. If you frame a situation where you understand your goal, you understand where you want to get to, and now you are formulating the plan of how to get there, and you're framing things differently. So you're showing the person that actually this is actually their idea. Their idea that they got this house and not the beach house. Their idea that they got the Porsche and not the Ferrari. Once you frame it differently, then basically you'll take a small lose, but in order to gain the main objective of this separation. And I can tell you that we work with families in this realm exactly in those cases. And those who win are normally the ones that are a bit above the emotional part of, I just want this person to suffer. And understand that does not bring them the good end result, but they want to understand how to resolve this properly and, you know, live a better life at the end.
Can you give us an example how a very like concrete, like, you know, how would that work? I don't know, in a divorce or settlement, whatever it is, like, you know, what's exactly the circumstances and how can you get the other person?
So, yes. So, number one, here actually, we do use sometimes psychologists to actually evaluate the personal traits of the other side and what actually, how they would react to certain offers that would come to the table. So we would be hired by one of the sides And then based on open source information and based on interviewing of the spouse, we would better understand the psychological traits of the other side and then understand their vulnerabilities or what makes them tick. Why are they emotional about a certain situation and what would be easier for them to absorb? So if somebody is a more, let's say, abusive person, and somebody, or if somebody is very, has very low self-esteem and self-confidence, you know that these kind of people, you don't want to push them into a corner because that will basically cause a very extreme reaction. Could be a violent reaction, either verbally or physically. These people, you want to address in a certain way. You want to build a scenario where they feel like they are actually the winners. They feel like the idea came from them. And after identifying this type of situation on that person's profile, we can manipulate through lawyers or through personal communication where the boundary should be and how this these should be approached in a personal manner.
And how can you make the other person think it's his idea? What would be an example? How can you do that?
You can put words based on things that happened in the past. So remember when we spoke about the beach house and you mentioned how you wanted to make this into your new workshop to work on boats. So I thought that, you know, this could be an amazing opportunity for you based on things that you mentioned in the past throughout the relationship, that this could be very, very interesting for you. So you basically asked for the beach house. And when you frame it like that, you would give him positive reinforcements. You're a wonderful father or you're a wonderful mother. You would not use the kids as a channel to send out bad messages. Even though the other person may be sending out really extreme messages, you would stick to you're a wonderful person, continue being a wonderful father, continue being a wonderful mother. You would use certain tactics to build up the self-esteem of the other person and make sure you're not humiliating them. In the case of that person that has a very low self-esteem.
That almost sounds like a kind person is automatically more of a manipulator.
Most of information is obtained via smile and not an extortion. Mm. The best type of information is always obtained through smiles. And kindness, and not through aggression. People close up in aggression. People open up to smiles.
So you would say persuasion, especially in this example, but I understand in most cases, is achieved faster or in a better way through trust than pressure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can use apply pressure in different ways. You can apply it with a smile or you apply it with anger. Mm. And when it's applied with a smile, it feels different. And that's where the framing is basically everything, how you frame it. And the more you build the trust, and I want to say even to a level where it's fake trust from your side, but you make the other person feel like they can trust you. But again, this is all for the goal, for the higher goal, not to make that person do something bad, but actually to create a better situation for the end goal that you want as an output.
I mean, where are like the lines where you say, okay, look, that is still ethical and that's like too much, right? That is not ethical anymore. That's not, that's not the behavior anymore you want to do. Like, what are the lines there? How can you also, you know, draw lines that you keep, right? Without like kind of getting the lines further and further away, right?
So are you asking us as a lawyer?
No, actually...
In a legal perspective?
No, in a legal perspective, I know it. But I'm more asking from an ethical perspective, right?
I'll give you a very simple answer that works for me. And I think it works for most people, unless you're a very bad person. You feel in your gut when you're crossing a line. When you're really harming somebody, that's where you need to stop that situation. But you will know. And we all obviously have different lines. We all have our lines, crossed somewhere else. Therefore, the answer is very vague here. It's not a clear line. Maybe the answer is it stops where it becomes illegal. That could be the case. But most people, most normal people, not psychopaths or people that are very, you know, they cannot read reality as it is, most people will stop way before it becomes illegal. Most people don't wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to steal a bag today, or I'm going to rob a car, or right? Most people don't get up like that, as a majority. If you leave your bag in a restaurant, the chances of you not getting it back, not only in Switzerland, in most countries around the world, the chances of you not getting it back are very low, because that would mean somebody is inherently decided today that he's going to probably steal something that's in his actions. And most people are not wired like that. And therefore, that's why I say, when you feel in your gut that you're doing something wrong, then that's when you need to look at yourself in the mirror and say, okay, have I crossed the line? Am I really hurting somebody? Is this becoming closer to the line of illegal? And that's where you'll
but
know.
But that depends a lot of the personal gut feeling, right?
A lot, yes. It's about values, morals. Yes, yes. In each culture, it could be different. In some cultures, there's more steps to harsh situations, and some cultures are more soft.
So how would you differentiate the different cultures?
That's a trick question.
you start.
Let's say cultures and individuals.
You mean how, can you a little bit...
I assume there are different cultures. Let's say there's a Western culture and other cultures that I think they probably have different lines. And, you know, maybe in one culture you can go further and I don't know. Like in one culture, maybe, like for example, I think in the Western culture, I think generally deception is seen very negatively.
Yeah.
Also, I personally, like, you know, it's like, but I think, for example, in other cultures, I think deception is seen differently and is more part of the game, right? How would you differentiate different cultures and, let's say, different rules that apply?
Yeah, I don't want to touch exactly on one culture or other, because I think every country, and it could be also in the eastern part of the world, there's different variations of cultures. So Asian are a bit different from Indian, Indian are a bit different from Russians, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the West, maybe you can classify towards between Europe, again, for the most part, it's not exactly a right framing. And then the U.S., for the most part, Western Europe and the U.S. And in each case, in each situation, I can tell you that we've had high-profile cases where we've had, let's say, spouses from completely different cultures, and we had to take that under consideration. And then we went back and we investigated a little bit of the family order and how they grew up and what setting they are in, how they grew up and what they are in today. And they're deciding on the best approaches. Because, yeah, like you said, some family values maybe in Africa are different than the ones in India, are different than the ones in China, and especially different in the U.S. And the U.S. is big, so it could be even different in different parts of the U.S. But we would definitely look at different areas to determine how people grew up in what setting and how they are wired to think.
Right.
You know, some people will say families above everything, and they will sacrifice anything for the family.
Right.
And some people, not so much. I mean, it's once true. they grow up, they leave the family nest, they feel that, you know, less obligated to defend the family pride or whatever you want to call it, as much as other cultures.
Right.
So you'd have to know, because that's where, let's say, humiliation comes in.
Right. Mm.
You know, if some cultures, if you humiliate somebody's family, that's like a very, very red line.
Right.
And some cultures say, okay, so we said something about my father. I don't care.
Right.
That's his problem, not mine.
Right.
Okay, so we take it differently.
And I mean, Max, you can think already now, but I think my line, for example, I think I have pretty difficulties to deceive someone, right? So, for example, let's say, give an example of what I think probably would work for me and what would not. I think if you know someone is a person from his personality, that certain things are important to this person, right? To say, look, okay, I make an offer that gives you something that is important to you. And this can be rational, right? It's just, but it's like in the open, it's no deception. I think that would be for me like ethical use or use that I could do. Whereas if I would, for example, say, oh, that was your idea, and I know it wasn't the idea of this person, it was just, it's just basically a lie, that's something I could not do. It would be, you know, so I think openness and let's, in a way, not misusing trust, but like, you know, I think that would be my line. I don't know where your line is, Mox.
It's hard to draw.
To you as well.
Hard to draw one line that fits all circumstances, but I think lying is for sure where we, as I understand, all three of us would draw the line. But I also think that making someone feel, the example you mentioned, Adi, making someone feel as if it was his explicit request. So maybe my line is different than yours. Is not necessarily a lie, because if it actually showed in the past that this person was interested in the beach house, taking your beach house example, you might not have to say it's what you asked for, but you can just re-emphasize that desire of his who really wanted this beach house. You might not want to say, so I wouldn't say personally, oh, you told me you wanted the beach house, but you were also always mentioning the beach house. I'm sure you want it. So that's my line. You know, maybe I'll try to frame it differently, but certainly not crossing the line, the lying line.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I have a very distinct understanding in my head of what is a lie and what is truth.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot in the middle. There's a big, I mean, the world is not black or white most of the times. I mean, this microphone is black for sure, right? We all agree on that. Okay, so that's maybe a one or a zero. But in relationships and in conversations, you can say something with omitting other information and then give a perception that that is the truth without telling the entire truth. Am I too confusing?
No, for sure.
No, absolutely.
Makes sense.
And that's the framing part that I'm getting to. That's the framing part. And that's not lying, but that's creating a version of the truth that is, let's say, it's not a one or a zero. So you're not lying, but you're giving a version that you want to hear, that Joel or Max, you want to hear now, that version of the truth.
And I also think it's really, it depends on what setting you're in, right? Personal, business, and how important this is, the end goal is. But for sure, framing sounds, throughout the whole conversation, it felt like framing is a big, big element of this whole mechanism.
Framing and motives.
Yeah. How do you do that? Like, I mean, Mark said, you know, like, so you are trained in all these techniques and you know them, right? How does your wife know you don't manipulate her all the time?
Oh, well, now she will.
No, but you see what I mean, right? I mean, if you already, is it like a second nature? Can you stop doing it? Is it like, how do you deal with that, right? I mean, having these techniques, or do you think it's completely fine? I don't know. That's
for me personally, I believe I have the ability to hold those things in an area where I live my life on a normal scale. I don't go around manipulating people, just like any other person. I think I'm a good person. I believe in good things, and I believe that people are good naturally, and I believe I'm good naturally, and I see the world in colors. So therefore, when you get to know somebody very closely, even you will know when your wife is manipulating you. You will know when your child is manipulating you. We all have that. We all have those radars. So as far as I'm concerned, I feel like I'm very, you know, I don't live my life trying to manipulate people. I may know how to prepare better for a high-end situation where I would like an outcome to be and favorable of me. But I believe that you know how to do this as well. If you have that awareness, you will know how to do this as well.
Right.
All you have to do is be aware of what you want, be aware of the data and information, understand and map out the motive of the other side, which most of the times you know because you're going into situations where you are familiar with. And if not, then understanding the motives through the conversations, and then acting on them in the way that eventually will serve your purpose.
Right.
So whatever I know, I promise you know as well.
Yeah, it's. I'll try to summarize it, and you tell me. Like, basically, it's for both, let's say, the bad and the good form of social engineering. It's similar, right? First, if you want to protect yourself, but also if you want to, like, you see where you analyze the data that's out and where are the vulnerabilities, right? That's step one. Step two is probably you define a goal. And then you see how these vulnerabilities, or you could also call them potentially, you know, let's say motivators, right? It could be negative or positive, whatever. And how these motivators, you know, go together with this goal. And then the third part would be like how to create a situation, and probably engineer a situation, where you can use these levers to get to your goal. Is that roughly the summary?
That is roughly the summary, yes. Absolutely. That is roughly the summary. Framing motives of the other person, a lot of listening to the subtext, understanding what the person is really asking from you, and then preparation, real preparation, and sticking to your goals inside that event and not moving from them and not being, taken off track by the other side. At least you have your compass. Now, things may go differently. That's okay. We're human beings. That's why this conversation at the end of the day is not a one and a zero. There's a lot of gray and colors inside this conversation. It's not something you can say explicitly, this will work 100%. No. What may work for you may not work for you, and vice versa.
Are there any specific, and now slowly coming towards the end, since we're running out of time, clear no-goes for any professional, let's talk professional context, when it comes to persuasion? So we just summarized the techniques that we should apply. Is there any red line you just say people should not cross?
I think we mentioned this. I think we are all at the end of the day living in a structured environment with laws. And I think to a point where you harm somebody physically or emotionally, I think that should be a red line, personally speaking. I think that's, but not only physical, emotional. I think at some point, if we understand and know the other person, we understand if we cause them emotional abuse. And I think that's an area, sometimes even more than physical abuse, it's an area that needs to be taken under consideration, especially for people that are close to us, but also for people that we may encounter just in a case that we're up against. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, the moral area. And I'm sure you guys have moral questions every day in your work about how far you want to go or you feel you think you should go in order to please your client or to win the case. I'm sure you encounter them every day. And well, maybe not every day, but every case I'm sure has this, its areas for sure.
Oh, for sure. It's a constant, I think it's a constant struggle, right? To see, you know, what's the best mix, right? For sure. And who you want to be also, right? I mean, it's like, you know, for me, at least, it's important, you know, to at the end of the day do something that you feel is for the greater good, right? In one way or another, and I think this is a very different approach than others have, for sure.
I think also speaking with people, with your peers, about a case, about a situation, about the extreme cases, I think really helps. Once you say things out loud, then you commit to them. Or you don't commit to them.
Right.
Because you understand what you're actually doing. It's right. No longer in your brain. It's not longer in your head. Then I think that really helps to dissolve it.
Right. So I give you now, I think it's probably the one or two last questions. So one question would be for you and one question would be for you, Max. And the one for you is one example to brag about, like one thing that you did in that space, be it defense or offense, no matter what, that you felt, wow, that was really a great success, and you know, we did that, and you know, maybe why. And then Max, maybe you can say the two or three things that you take away from the podcast.
So We had a case where we were hired by a senior, very senior person who was managing a big fund. And he was trying to build a new fund, and he wanted to get a, let's say, a very public figure to join this fund and to lead it. And that public figure, we had to assess. He was very publicly, his information was very public. And he wanted, he for no doubt was a very narcissistic type person. Always wanted to be pleased. And you had to tell him all the time how great he was. And his ideas were the best. And when it didn't come from him, they were not relevant. And we had to somehow convince that person to actually eventually say from him that he wanted to lead this fund. And that was not an easy case because he had so much things in his life going on. And it's not, you know, these people are normally very, very busy. So eventually we were able to get him into a room, into a meeting. And we created a scenario where one of our analysts created a presentation where during the presentation, he mentioned the fact that we are going to build a fund. He didn't say who, but he says we. And we are going to have 5 people on the board. And we're going to have everybody will have a vote. And it will be amazing. And he gave the content of the fund. And then our client said, who came up with this horrible idea? This is not a democracy. We don't want 5 people to decide. Eventually, it's going to be one person who will have to lead this fund. We will find this person and threw that analyst out the door and says, go give me another plan. Basically, the meeting ended at that note. And 2 weeks later, we got a call from the other guy who basically said, you know, I had an idea about that fund that you were talking about. How about we have a meeting to discuss it? And basically that led to a huge business success. And we kind of anticipated, we gave him time to absorb it, to kind of sink in. And eventually that person actually became the head of that fund. So that was a kind of a manipulation inside a meeting where we orchestrated internally that eventually led to something. So that was kind of unique to see that happening in the real world. That was a great success on our end.
That's a brilliant example.
It's pretty interesting. So for me, I mean, thanks so much, Adi. It was very, very interesting and insightful also. And the main topic or what I take away from this conversation is really to find good ways of how to use those techniques and be persuasive, but also at the same time be aware of when we might be subject to manipulation and persuasion. So there's those two sides to the whole story. And I think some 3 or 4 key points that are relevant for both of these aspects are one, to know and understand our own vulnerabilities and our discussion partners' vulnerabilities. I think the first part, knowing our own vulnerabilities, is a process that we should all go through, and this is probably beneficial for any individual and company.
And painful.
And painful, for sure. The other one, understanding the discussion partners' vulnerabilities, has, of course, needs some research work that needs to be done, and maybe also some getting to know the person, right? Some interaction. And connected to that, being conscious of what we share and what others share, sharing in conversations, but also digital footprint, our online presence, and so forth. So those two elements are the context, kind of, that I really take away that we should all be conscious of. And then to work with trust and not with pressure in those moments when we try to achieve something. Of course, there are certain moments, you mentioned it, Adi, where pressure might need to be applied, but overall, trust can be stronger than the pressure. And lastly, and I think that's the difficult or most difficult element, it's to listen to our gut feeling. It's what you mentioned throughout. And obviously, it's something that truly depends on your personality and a bit on whether you have that sense of a gut feeling and whether you're a good person or not. But yes, so those are the four elements, I'd say, that I really take away from today's episode. I don't know if I forgot anything important. Maybe you want to add to that, Adi, or you, Joel?
I think you summed it up really nice.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Adi.
Thank you very much for
hosting. It was a great discussion.
Appreciate it.
Food for thought.
For sure. So thank you very much, Adi, for your interesting insights again and the engaging conversation. I really appreciated it. And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. On behalf of the entire podcast team, I'd like to sincerely thank you all for your support so far. If you enjoy the podcast, we would, of course, greatly appreciate subscription and the rating. We also welcome any feedback, input, or topic suggestions at any time. Thank you very much, and until next time. We'll be right back.